This is a download of the highlights from today's Woman's Hour. Copyright issues mean that we can't always include all the items from the programme. Good morning to you. And on the programme today, as a tribute to the late, great Maeve Binchy, we will play part of an interview that she gave to Jenny on Woman's Hour 3 years ago. That's in about 10 minutes' time. Also today, would an affair be the end of your long-term relationship? Does it have to be? After our discussion last week on the increase in female cosmetic genital surgery, how do we know what is really normal? And this is Alex Scott. She's playing for Great Britain in the Olympic football tournament at Wembley tonight.
Thinking about it now, I get like butterflies in my belly to be walking out in the stadium. You know, it's going to be different. You're used to playing for England, but to have a GB team on and say I was part of that Olympics will just be fantastic.
It's all very well for her. What is it like for her mum? Her mum is here. Her mum is called Carol Scott. Carol, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Also with us, we have Gary McCafferty, who is married to Lynn. And Lynn, Gary, is the captain of the GB women's handball team.
That's correct, yeah.
Now, you were a handball player yourself. I mean, a useful one too.
Yeah, I was. I was part of the men's programme back in 2006 when it all kind of kicked off for the Olympics.
And you don't play anymore?
I play at home in Scotland for my local club, but I've not been part of the programme for 4.5 years now.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about your domestic arrangements. Actually, they're not really domestic because you and Lynn can't be together, really, can you, for a whole variety of sporting reasons. But we'll get on to that in a moment. Carol, take us back in time then to the first time the young Alex kicked a ball. Where was that?
That was in our local like grounds, and she used to play with all the boys, mainly her brother and that, because there was no girls' teams available for her to play with then, and she just used to go and have a good kick about with all the boys. And she, you know, she was so good that they let her in the team.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, it's a measure of their respect for her.
Yes.
She was allowed to play with
yes.
the boys.
And out of all of them, she's the only one that's actually done really, really well in
and
the sport.
Those lads that she knocked about with then, they're still part of her life and part of your
life?
Yeah,
they still come round every time, you know, when she's on the telly, and they still come round to see her brother, and they're still cheering her on to this day. So.
This was all in Tower Hamlets
yes.
in East London,
yeah.
So not far at all. From
just
the
down
stadium.
The road from the Olympic Stadium.
Were you at the opening ceremony?
No, I wasn't. No, I was watching it at home. I could hear it. I could hear all the fireworks
I bet you could.
from
and
the window.
What was Alex doing on Friday night then?
They was in Cardiff because they was actually preparing for the game on the Saturday against Cameroon. So, but they was all dressed up, all watching the opening ceremony and everything, so they was enjoying it as much as, even though they wasn't there.
So they were suited and booted in
oh,
their
yes.
kit.
Oh, yes.
And watching the show. Well, that's fantastic. It gives us an insight into yeah. just how seriously it's all taken,
mm-hmm.
and rightly.
Yeah.
It is amazing, isn't it, that, as you say, she was kicking a ball about with those lads, and many of whom, I think, went for trials at
yeah,
clubs.
Yeah, her own brother did as well. Yeah,
right, they were good players. Yeah. She is the one who tonight will play in front of, we think, a crowd of over 70,000 people.
Hopefully.
What will that mean to her?
Oh, that will be absolutely. She's played. They've played in big crowds, but nothing like this. And once the crowd gets behind them, that will. I think that will spur them on even more to hopefully win against Brazil tonight. That will be like winning the gold just to get through. And you know, even though they're already through, it's. It will be good. It'll be
I was
really
going to say, some of the pressure is taken off
yeah.
because they don't have to win.
No.
But just explain why a win would be useful.
Well, it's to get to the top of that actual league, you know, the table, and then it just gets a little bit easier. It's the next round, and it just, I think they need to go through knowing that they've won every game, and that just gives them that little bit more, you know, to look forward to for a medal, please God.
Well, I'm going tonight, and I know that you're going to be there, but apparently
yeah.
you don't pay full attention to what's going on the pitch.
Too nervous. I just sit there. If there's like, sometimes there's little screens, little tellies up there, what you can actually watch as well, I just watch the clock. Just hurry up, 90 minutes.
So if Great Britain get a goal in the first 10 minutes, all you're doing is clock watching,
yeah,
waiting
clock
for
watching, yeah.
the 92nd
yeah.
minute or whatever
even
it's going to be.
On the last game, even though there was 3-0 up, I was, come on, 90 minutes, come on.
Oh, you're whistle ref. And Gary, explain why you've never actually lived with Lynn, have you, since you got married?
Not since we got married. We had already arranged our wedding prior to the Olympic programme starting for handball. So we decided that we were going to go ahead with it, even though that we were going to be living in Denmark at the time. And we lived in separate parts of Denmark. So we got married in January 2007 when we were both on the programme, and then I came home the following year, and Lynn's still been travelling Europe up until obviously this year, until the start of the Games.
Well, we've interviewed Lynn, and let's just hear a little extract. Here she is talking, in fact, about you, Gary.
He's a massive help to me and the biggest support that I've ever had. I couldn't have done it without him, for sure. It's really hard for me to be down here, and it's probably even harder for him because he's working a 9-to-5 job and I'm doing something that I love.
I suppose she's making the point that she is having the fun and you're doing the tough stuff. Is that, does she actually say that to you, or is she only prepared to say it about you behind your back, do you think?
I think she's only willing to say it behind my back. We have a laugh because I've managed to work in London some this year, and I'll come home from being out the house for 12 hours travelling and working, and I'll come in and her and her teammates will be sitting and they'll say, oh, we've had such a tough day. I could, like, we had to train and then we had to come home for lunch, and like they deal with lunch as if it's like an abnormal part of your day. It's like a task. Like,
to eat.
Yeah. Like, no, that isn't a hard day.
No, I've had a hard day, that's what you should say. So you work in an office?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Is this partly to fund what Lynn is up to?
Yeah, well, of course, myself and our parents have been a massive help, and friends as well. But yeah, I mean, my salary kind of pays for the bills and helps her along her way.
What will life be like then for you both as a couple after all this is over?
It'll be really good. I think we're both just really looking forward to having...
to being married.
Yeah, to having a normal life and really having married life together. Obviously, all my friends say, like, oh, you've got the ideal marriage. Like, you get to do what you want, you can go out when you want. But, you know, it is hard living yourself for so long and your nearest and dearest being so far away.
Well, you understand the game of handball, so it's a slightly different position from Carol's, I think. I'm not saying you don't understand football, but it's slightly different when it's your child. Do you criticise your wife's performance?
I would never criticise her performance, but sometimes, like, she likes to bounce ideas off me, or when she's played, I can give her some feedback, and I can discuss the game with her a bit more objectively than like some other family members who haven't been involved in the sport.
We don't want to be negative. They have lost both their first games, but I don't think they expected to win either of them, did they?
They didn't, no. Both the teams they've played twice already this year in European qualifiers, and they had lost to them both times. Both of them are medal prospects, so they didn't expect to win either of these games. And on Saturday against Montenegro, they had a great match. They played really well, apart from a small spell. And sometimes in handball it's difficult because there's so many goals. A small spell is all it can take for the scoreline to run away.
Right. So the next game is?
The next game is Brazil tomorrow.
Just something about the word Brazil. I mean, instantly I think, oh, they're bound to be good. Yeah. Are they?
Yes.
Yeah, they would be, yeah, okay.
They came fourth at the World Championships.
Ah, okay, so it's another stiff challenge, to say the least.
Yeah. It's another stiff challenge, but hopefully they can get a good performance. And Brazil are a team they have a chance of competing with.
Do you feel, both of you actually, do you feel part of it, Carol? Do you feel included by the British Olympic people?
Oh, yeah, we went into the village last night to see her, and, you know, you're given goodie bags. They're treating you absolutely marvellous, you know. It's just great. They are lovely.
And you too, yeah?
I've not been to the family house yet, but I'm going on Friday. But, yeah, I mean, even just in and around the park, everyone's been great, and the way that everyone, the way it's working has just been so good, and everyone's so friendly and so helpful. It's just been such a great atmosphere to be involved in.
That's really good to hear. Thank you both so much, and I'm rooting for both, for your wife of course, Gary, and for Alex tonight. And it's such an important moment for British women's football, actually, for football for women in this country, and to think of that huge crowd at Wembley tonight will just be brilliant. I know, sorry, I'm making it worse for you. Carol and Gary, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Now, as you may well have heard, the great Irish writer Maeve Binch she has died at the age of 72. Once a journalist with the Irish Times and a reporter for Woman's Hour for a time back in the 70s, she sold over 40 million books. Firefly Summer, Silver Wedding, Circle of Friends, Tara Road. I'm sure you've got your own favourite. And her gift was to write brilliantly and movingly about so-called ordinary people, leading what seemed on the surface to be an unspectacular sort of life. Of course, it was never really true. Well, her first novel was the one that I liked best. That was Lighter Penny Candle, the story of a lifelong friendship between two women, one Irish and one English, Aisling and Elizabeth. And it may have been she talked to Jenny about the success of that novel, how it transformed her life, not just her life, actually, but that of her husband, Gordon, as well.
Well, it transformed our lives because Gordon and I, in this house here, we were paying, it was £232 a month, but this is 1981, 82, as a mortgage. Now, we had a house in England. We bought this for our old age, as we laughingly called it, thinking it was about 1,000 years away. And £232 a month seemed an awful lot of money to find each month. So we were a month and a half overdue for the mortgage. Now, I would thought of losing this lovely little house. I couldn't bear it, really. And so then on the day that there was the auction, they had an auction for the paperback rights of this book. And I was told to be home, they'd ring me and tell me what it made. And I remember, I don't pray, but I remember saying to God, if you're out there listening, I'm just transferring a thought to you. It would be quite wrong to pray for more money. But if you could see your way towards 5,000, make things terrific. And so then that day they rang and said, are you sitting down? And I said, yes. And they said, no, you're not. Sit down. So I sat down on the stairs. And he said, it's got more than any first novel ever got. It's got £52,000. I could not believe it. I could not believe it. I said, could you just say that again? And they said, and I said, do I get it or do you get it? And they said, we're very much afraid you get it. So I thought this was such great news. And when Gordon came home, I said, well, I think our little house is safe.
Your depiction of men in the books is often not quite what one would expect from such an incredibly happily married woman. One commentator said, it's been a while since I've enjoyed such a loutish, incompetent, drunken, selfish collection of men in one novel. That was Lighter a Penny Candle. You often let men let your heroines down. Why?
Well, I suppose before I did meet Gordon, I had my chance of kissing a number of frogs before I found the prince. And I realised that women were, I think they're much more intelligent now. I mean, you see, I'm you know, beyond understanding what the young people nowadays think. But I think that they weren't as foolish as we were. See, when I was young, in the 50s, it was quite acceptable that if you were going out with your girlfriends to somewhere, if a man, any man, asked you out and you said, no, I've got a date with a man, of dropping all the arrangements with women. I don't think girls do that now. Also, women of my age thought that if a man said, I love you, he meant it. I mean, you know, it was not just ever regarded as a bargaining tool for sex or that it would be just because he might have felt it for that 2 moments. We thought that he meant that he was now committed firmly, permanently, and would stay by your side forever. And so, quite obviously, if you came with that, if you approached the relationship with that mentality, you know, there were going to be quite a few disappointments in store. And also, I think people are happy to read about other women who have made mistakes because women can be incredibly foolish. And it's not that I have been surrounded by evil men. My father was the best man in the world. Gordon is also the best man. And my bosses in the Irish Times and publishers I've dealt with have all been very kind and good. So I've had much more social contact with men that were good. But there's more excitement about a woman who is enslaved by passions, to use a very dramatic way of looking at it, and foolishly involved with somebody, you know, who really doesn't feel equal commitment at all.
So how did you get so lucky with Gordon? How did that come about, that relationship?
Well, amazingly, it came about through Woman's Hour. I once wrote a letter to a theatre critic to attack him about something he had said, and he told me he thought it was very funny. He said, why don't you send it to Woman's Hour? They might broadcast it. It was very entertaining. So I sent it in to Woman's Hour, not believing for a moment they would. And the next thing, I got a letter from Woman's Hour saying if I was in London, perhaps I would come and record it because it was entertaining. And so the producer that I met in Woman's Hour, who later became a great friend, introduced me to Gordon. And so I owe entirely my many, many years of happiness to a chance meeting arranged through Woman's Hour. I would always be grateful to them. Every time I hear them, things start, I feel a little glow of pleasure.
Maeve Finchie, the Irish writer, and I know that her books meant so much to so many of you. And there will be another chance to hear much more from that interview that Maeve Finchie gave to Jenny 3 years ago on Weekend Woman's Hour this Saturday afternoon. If you're in a long-term relationship, do you think it could survive infidelity? Perhaps it already has. In fact, of course, you might not even know it. Is being faithful as important as it once was? And what constitutes infidelity anyway? Is it sex? Is it a kiss? Is it a series of soul-bearing conversations? Well, here are some of your tweets and emails on the subject.
The importance of fidelity depends on the people involved. For me, it's crucial, but I have friends who have an open and happy marriage.
I was the long-distance mistress for 11 years of a man who lived with his partner and whom I found irresistible. I only woke up from this when he told me he was getting married and planning to start a family, but asked if he could fit in a meeting before the wedding and continue to meet after he was married. He suggested covert annual holidays away. I finally saw the light and cut off all contact from that moment. In fact, it was a relief. The affair had cost me my own happy relationship, hurt the man who really loved me very badly, and left me struggling with crippling guilt and regret for many years. I'm happy now and learned a lot from all this, but would like to warn anyone tempted to embark on an affair that you're likely to lose so much more than you could ever gain. Just don't do it.
It was my husband who had the affair. I was 56 at the time, and I left him as a result. The road to understanding, coming to terms and moving on has been interesting.
Before we married, both of us had enjoyed many partners, but we did promise to be faithful after our marriage. In the next 30 years, there were times when I suspected my wife had strayed, but she always denied it and I had no reason to doubt her. We were at a party. Late in the evening, I needed to use the loo and went upstairs. To my horror, I found my wife in bed with her lover. She admitted that her behaviour had been unforgivable and we were divorced as soon as possible afterwards, and it was only then that we were honest with each other. She admitted to having had various affairs over the years, and we both agreed that we'd fallen out of love many years before. We should have separated a dozen years earlier and led new lives. Couples must be honest with each other.
I'm experiencing the fallout of over 10 years of unfaithfulness by my ex-partner, only recently discovered and evidence still coming to light. I accepted the first one as it was in the past, and he said he deeply regretted it. But since then, more and more came to light, which showed an equally bad thing. How good a liar he'd always been.
Well, thank you to everybody who got in touch. And if you'd like to send us a tweet now when we discuss the subject, or whilst we do, then you can do that, of course. It's at BBC Woman's Hour. Well, Andrew G. Marshall is a Relate counsellor and the author of How Can I Ever Trust You Again? And Kay Wellings is a professor of sexual and reproductive health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Andrew, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Now, on the whole, our listeners suggest that infidelity had been pretty harmful to their relationship. What do you think? Does it play a crucial part in most long-term relationships?
Hopefully, most long-term relationships don't actually suffer from infidelity. But if you don't sort out the problems and you just bury them, which is what a lot of people do, that... And temptation comes along. For some reason, people think that a moment of passion is going to solve all of their problems. It's going to make them feel better. And they end up having what I call a self-medicating affair. Unfortunately, all it does is take the problems in their marriage and blow them up and make them 1,000 times better.
But, what sort of marital problems are you talking about?
Well, it could be absolutely anything. It could be, for example, there's tension between a husband and wife because the wife earns more than the husband. Or, for example, he hates his mother-in-law. And these subjects...
Well, all the other way round.
Oh, sorry, or the other way round. But these subjects, if you can't actually talk about them, you can't actually solve them. And they begin to build up one after another until you've got basically a wall between the two of you. Now, that's the point when really you should actually be getting some help. But unfortunately, people think, well, it's not that bad, we'll soldier on. And often one person is sort of desperately sad, but instead of actually saying something, they think, well, nobody's going to find out. It's just my little moment of pleasure. But the truth is, you will always be found out. The thing that has changed dramatically over the 25 years I've been working in this area is that every last piece of your communication will be found out. Every little fantasy that you expunge will be read by your partner in devastating detail and probably shared with your children as well, and your life will be made a complete and utter living hell. Don't do it.
Yeah, your National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyles looked at what you call concurrent relationships. Now, can you just expand? What does that mean?
Yes, it's not a phrase that trips off the lip easily. But we use that term, because terms like unfaithful and cheating and affairs have a very value-laden feel to them. And how we talk about infidelity influences how it's seen and also how it's measured. If we ask people, have you been unfaithful, they're going to see it as very differently than if we simply ask them about when their relationship started and when it ended. So that's what we do. And concurrent partners are partnerships in which sex is taking place with a second person within the time period in which someone's still having sex with the first one. So that's the more scientific term for what we're trying to get at.
But it's generally been accepted that men are more likely to have affairs. Is that still the case, Kay?
Up to date, but it's changing. In the last survey we conducted, around 1 in 6 men and 1 in 10 women reported having had concurrent partnerships in the past year. Now, when we look at the younger ages, 16 to 24, the gap's smaller. So 21% of men and 15% of women in that age group had concurrent partners. And we very much expect that when our results come through from this most recent survey, that we're going to see that that gap between men and women is closed still further.
Andrew, I'm just looking at a tweet from a woman who says, my husband had a so-called Facebook affair and I can't tell you the damage it's caused in our marriage. Well, that leads us back to what you were saying, that there's very little hiding place, isn't there, these days?
There isn't, and unfortunately we don't actually discuss what we mean by monogamy these days, because I would say there's sort of four kinds of monogamy. There is what I call fundamental monogamy, which is for example, even private masturbation or looking at pornography would be considered unfaithful. In the words of President Carter, I've been unfaithful in my mind many times. There is what the vast majority of people live in, which is don't ask, don't tell. We don't actually debate with our partner, because let's face it, it wouldn't be a very nice conversation, what actually constitutes infidelity. We have creative monogamy, which is where we actually, instead of trying to pretend that we're two maiden aunts living together, which of course isn't very sexy, we actually use the small amount of jealousy that, say, for example, at a party, I had a friend who was had a man who was being incredibly interested in her and sort of flirting with her. And after the party, her husband said, oh, that man seemed very interested in you. And rather than saying, which a lot of people would say, oh, no, don't be so stupid, she said, yes, he was very interested in me. And her husband said, well, why were you interested in him? And she said, because it's the first time in a long time somebody's made me feel like a woman, which is an incredibly honest thing to say.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it would have... Well, perhaps it did help their relationship.
Well, did, because he said to her when you got home, get up those stairs and I'll make you feel like a woman again. And, you know, they had passionate and wonderful sex because they could be open with each other. And then the fourth kind of monogamy is sort of post-monogamy, where people sort of effectively tell each other everything about their infidelity. But I have to say that's like 0.5% of the population, my guess would be.
Kay, you've spoken to women and to men who've been betrayed. How easy did they find it to move on and, well, perhaps even strengthen their relationship?
Well, I think that very much depends on how it's seen, and I agree with many of the comments already made that it depends really whether it's a sort of deficiency in the relationship where it's seen as something missing, something wrong with the relationship. Now, in those cases, it might be a trigger for a sort of crisis intervention, that people really examine what's going on in their relationship and try to put it right. But not everybody can do that.
I would say that you can look at infidelity as the worst thing that happened to your marriage, or you could look at it as the turning point, because my experience is it is possible to turn around relationships, to go from discovery to recovery. The important thing is that you do actually communicate with each other properly, because at the bottom of every set of infidelity is poor communication. We're not taught how to discuss difficult subjects like we're not having enough sex anymore in our relationship. If people can talk about this stuff, nine times out of ten, it can all be sorted by people like myself. So it might seem bleak, but there is hope. Believe me.
Andrew G. Marshall of Relate, a positive note to end on, and Kay Wellings we'll hear from again later in this edition of Woman's Hour, because she's a contributor to our discussion on female genitalia. What is normal? That's a little bit later in the programme today. Now, in the latest in our series on Londoners' wardrobes, we enter now the sartorial world of Denise Jagger, who's a partner at the city law firm Eversheds. She also sits on a number of boards, including the British Olympic Association. Though she headed up the legal team at Asda, the supermarket chain, for a while, she has spent most of her career in the City of London. She's in her 50s, and she says her wardrobe has become less restrictive as she's got older. Henrietta Harrison went to meet her at her flat in Tower Bridge.
Well, I have realised doing this that I wear far too much beige. So this is a beige linen dress, which is very plain, A-line, no arms, and then a jacket which is a sort of deeper fawny colour with cream checks. So that just brightens the whole thing up. I think you have to recognise, if you choose a particular career, you can't be completely, flow against the tide, because if your clients feel uncomfortable with you because you've come in with a punk hairdo and earrings, for example, it's not what they'd be expecting. It would knock them off balance and it might disrupt the relationship and the conversation and the rapport. So I think you do have to recognise, if you move into this sort of profession, that there are certain codes, in the same way as codes of behaviour and perhaps codes of dress. But I like to think that I will follow that, but try to bring in some individuality as well.
Are there any outfits that you would wear, say, for example, you had a challenging day, so you'd wear something because you knew you felt good in it and it gave you that extra confidence?
Oh, definitely. I always do. I don't just decide I'm wearing a dress because I haven't worn it for a while. I really think about the event. Quite often I give presentations, so then that's really important that I feel confident if I'm standing up in front of a large audience. This dress, for example, it's grey wool, so it doesn't crease, it's very straight, it's got a zip all the way down the front, and I just feel very confident in that because I think it flatters my figure. I haven't got things, belts or bits I've got to watch that my shirt's untucked or my belt's undone or whatever. So I can feel really confident when I'm standing up.
That's a designer dress, isn't it? Do you think the cut gives you confidence? Do you think you would be happy standing in a high street dress?
I think the reason I feel confident is that the cut is good and I think there's a lot more space in them, so they really suit your figure. And the trouble with less expensive dresses is I find sometimes if the lining will roll up or they'll get creased, I become self-conscious that things aren't hanging, particularly if I'm standing up in front of people, because people inevitably, staring at you for a while if you're giving a speech. Work's important, so I've got to invest money in looking the part, really.
Is there anyone or anything that you're trying to not look like? Is there a look that you're trying to avoid?
Well, I will certainly try to avoid looking as if I'm trying to look too young, because I really think that's dreadful when people wear clothes that are too tight. I don't know why people do it, and it must be uncomfortable, and it shows off their figures in the, invariably it's people who have too large who wear really tight clothes. So I would always be careful that sometimes I'll see something I absolutely love, but I just feel in my 50s, that's not something I should be wearing, no matter how fashionable it is and how much I like the style.
Have you ever made any fashion faux pas at work, do you think?
I think when I very first started, I was working in the city and I was still a trainee solicitor, and I was actually working litigation, so we were going to court, because obviously solicitors don't go to court very often. And this particular day, again, I had this rebellious streak that I didn't really want to conform. So I didn't really worry about it. I thought, well, I'll wear a navy jacket, so that's, conforming. But I actually had a skirt on which was sort of striped orange and red. It sounds dreadful, but it was silk, it was beautiful. And I had it with orange shoes. And so I went into the office and I could see my principal, who knew we were going to court later on in the morning, looking at me. But he didn't say anything, luckily. But it wasn't until the taxi ride home, he did say, well, this is running on, or we'll be in court tomorrow. It would be better if you wore something a little more sober. So it didn't really matter, but it was, I think I was getting mildly told off about it. This is an Armani jacket. Again, it's a wonderful material. I don't know what it is, but it's, you can completely crease it up. I think it's a, what colour that is really, a muddy colour with black, and then it's trimmed with some velvet on the collar, and then I can wear it with either black trousers or I can wear just a plain black skirt, which I've got it with here.
So what impression do you want to give at work?
I think I want to look professional and confident, but I don't want to look intimidating. I'm not trying to create a distance. You know, I need to be approachable. I need to look relaxed and confident.
You hold a number of non-executive directorships for various organisations. Can you just explain what that involves?
The most exciting at the moment, for obvious reasons, is the British Olympic Association. So I joined their board last year as an independent director. You know, we clearly attend board meetings. We're guiding and supporting the executive team.
Again, you would wear the same sort of work outfits to those sorts of meetings, would you?
Yes, to those meetings. They're held in London. Most, you know, it's a pretty professional organisation, so I would certainly wear my similar work wardrobe to that. But by contrast, I'm also a non-executive director. Again, it's an unpaid role, but for the Northern Ballet. And, of course, completely different. They're very artistic. For example, we had an opening last week of the latest ballet, I've Got Rhythm. So it's great. I took a group of friends along in the evening due to my role as a director and was able to wear quite a sort of flamboyant evening.
You can go wild.
Yeah.
Who would you say you dress for?
Oh, myself, definitely. I mean, clearly, my family and my friends, I wouldn't like to turn up looking a mess. But, you know, for example, if you're invited somewhere, you wouldn't insult people by turning up really scruffily. But first and foremost, I think about what I feel good in. So I wouldn't wear something because somebody suggested I should or I'd look good in it necessarily. I'll choose things that I feel good in and I feel comfortable in.
So what do you wear when you're relaxing at the weekends with your family?
I love it. I mean, summer now, I just love wearing cut-off jeans and things. So jeans I wear, I just bought these really lovely, comfortable, sort of cut-off white trousers.
A bit stretchy, are they?
Yes, yeah, and they just suit... See, I've found that they just suit my figure, so that's why I'll return there. So I'll wear that sort of thing. In fact, I'm usually quite informal at the weekend because I'm wearing smart clothes during the week. I almost go the other way and I don't have enough dressy clothes for out of work.
But, I mean, it's white jeans and quite smart, nice fabrics. It's not like a tracksuit. I mean, I'd spend the weekend in a tracksuit. It's not... I mean, I'd wear those clothes to work, you see.
Because I'm so smart. To me, relatively, that's pretty... Yes, I see what you mean. I mean, I do wear tracksuits a lot to the gym, but I wouldn't wear them at home.
You wouldn't hang around in a tracksuit at home?
No, I'd only wear my tracksuit to the gym.
Really? Do you ever wear flip-flops or trainers?
Trainers to the gym, flip-flops around the pool, but otherwise...
You wouldn't wear trainers to the supermarket?
Well, actually, I have to confess, where I now go to the gym is really near Waitrose. So actually, sometimes I think I really should go home and get changed because I've got my gym kit on. I look terrible, but it's just so efficient if I can zip into the supermarket on the way home. So I zip through hoping nobody sees me dressed in... I literally wear those lycra sort of things you wear in the gym and trainers. And inevitably I go and bump into somebody I know, which is dreadful.
Denise Jagger, who sounds like an example to us all. I was going red there because I spend about 85% of my waking life in tracksuit bottoms. Henrietta Harrison was the reporter. And a quick trip to Correction Corner before we move on. Andrew G. Marshall no longer works for Relate. Now, last week, you might recall our discussion on the rise in female cosmetic genital surgery. The British Journal of Obstetrics and Gynaecology has reported an increase in the number of women with normal-sized labia minora seeking labial reduction. Now, the official NHS view is that labia, like everything else, come in all shapes and sizes, and they only present a problem when they affect a woman's working, social or sporting life. So why are some women so determined to correct what they see as an abnormality? Well, Kay Wellings is still with us, the Professor of Sexual and Reproductive Health. Claire Chambers joins us from Cambridge. She's from the Faculty of Philosophy at Jesus College. Claire, good morning to you.
Hello.
And Susan Bewley, Professor Susan Bewley, is an obstetrician and gynaecologist and has been working in those fields for some 30 years. Susan, welcome to you. Now, if anybody's qualified to tell us about female genitals, it is you. They come, presumably, in all shapes and sizes.
They do indeed. Sadly, we weren't trained very well in this, and a lot of textbooks have got a standard picture, sometimes with the clitoris missing. But some work by our international expert, Sarah Crichton, here in the UK, has actually gone and looked at normal measurements, and they're very wide and divergent.
So normal can be any... I mean, let's be really precise about this, as you're here and you are an expert and we don't need to be remotely embarrassed. What is normal?
Well, what is normal, for example, in the clitoris length, can be from 1/2 to 3.5 centimetres. The labia majora, that's the outside lips, yeah, can be up to 12 centimetres. And the labia minora, the inside lips, can be up to 5 to 10 centimetres in width and length.
And will they change throughout adult life at all?
They change at puberty from the children's genitalia, which are quite flat, and we sprout breasts, hair, and our labia change. And in the menopause, the skin gets a bit thinner, but they don't really change very much. They can change with childbirth if people have tears or scars, but no, they're just very diverse.
And what about weight gain, for example, or weight loss?
They don't change very much with that, although the mons pubis, the bit at the front underneath the bikini line, can be a little bit fattier with the pads there, but again, not enormously different.
So do you understand why so many women now are of the view that things aren't quite right?
I don't think we understand enough why women appear to be more dissatisfied than they did in the past. Certainly, as when I was training in obstetrics and gynaecology, very few women came in saying there's something wrong down there. A lot of women feel uncomfortable or anxious or nervous or embarrassed when you're examining them. They think it must be a terrible job.
They say that to you, do they?
They do, and they're often apologising. A small minority really feel very uncomfortable enough that they think they're abnormal. It's a very rewarding job to be able to say to women, no, that's totally normal, because having seen hundreds and thousands of vulvas and vaginas...
You've really seen the lot, haven't you?
Yes. So, but it isn't like men. We don't show each other genitals after our childhood. And the images, if women went to look for images, they would see very abnormal images.
Well, what about the influence of porn then?
Well, if in pornography, we know that people actually use graphics to remove the images. And we see on cosmetic genital sites, surgeon sites, abnormal genitalia in the after photographs. If women were wanting to find out what was normal, they could look at things like femalia, or they could look at Show Your Vagina, a website with women showing the range of normal, or they could look at the artwork, The Great Wall of Vagina, where lots of casts of women have been shown.
And so you'd find proof there that you were no more abnormal than any of the rest of us,
you'd
frankly
see the huge range.
Claire, let's get the philosophical point of view then. I was a bit worried about the degree of self-loathing that some of Susan's patients seem to exhibit. What's all that about?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the problem really is what we understand by normal. And I mean, philosophically speaking, what is seen as normal depends on our social context through a process of social construction. And social construction works in two main ways. It affects the options that are available, and it affects our preferences. And it's really the preferences that you're seeing when you're looking at the self-loathing of women. In terms of the social construction of options, what we think of as normal depends on what is available and what seems appropriate for us. So cosmetic surgery has to be available in order for us to think it might be appropriate. And also our images of what's appropriate in terms of the appearance of our genitals depends on either what we see in pornography, as you mentioned, or what we don't see if we don't know what is normal. But in terms of the social construction of preferences, this is really the kind of fundamental way that social norms work. People want to conform to social norms, and this may be a kind of very conscious process. We know that there is a norm that exists of appearance that we want to adhere to so that it will bring us success, happiness, whatever it might be. But social norms also internalise themselves. Our preferences are shaped in a way that's not always obvious to us. So we actually want to adhere to norms of beauty in particular because they seem right to us. I mean, a good example of this is that we have a very strong norm in Britain, in Western societies, that men should wear trousers and not skirts. And if we ask a man who's wearing trousers, why are you doing that? He might say, well, I want to conform to the social norm that I should wear trousers so that I ensure that people don't laugh at me.
Yes.
But he's much more likely to say, well, I want to wear trousers. They look better. What do you mean? So, you know, he's internalised that norm. And that's something that happens, I think, with social norms across the board.
Kay, is there real evidence then that women are starting to care more about how their genitalia look? And where do you think it comes from?
Well, in terms of the evidence, as Susan said, we don't know enough yet. What we do know is that in this country particularly, it's quite a modest trend at the moment. Only about 1 in 10,000 women actually have surgery to enhance their genital area. There are far more inquiries and they are increasing, but at the moment it is quite a modest trend. Now, whether it becomes bigger, I think, depends on exactly programmes like this. I think women do need to be reassured. It's very odd that we seek to be normal in sexual matters where we're desperate to be different in our dress, in our eating and so on. And it's very odd, really, that our genital area is seen as... I think we need to see normal, what people mean by normal, and I think they think of perfect. But every genital area is different. All our faces are different. We wouldn't dream of wanting to make our faces standard and normal. They're what make us unique.
Well, of course, but there's plenty of people who'd have cosmetic surgery on their face.
Sure, but that's when it's not so much the search for normal as a search for rejuvenation, lifting up and making look youthful again. I also think that women are really barking up the wrong tree. Women who do go in for surgery genitally are paying large sums of money that they think improves their appearance. There's absolutely no evidence that it improves their sexual function. And if you put a search into Google, you'll see tens of thousands of references to procedures, yeah, but very little evidence that it improves
things. Any of them
things.
Will help. OK. And Claire, just a quick word on where this takes us when we think about our obsession with physical perfection.
Absolutely. Well, the norms that we have to adhere to in terms of our appearance and physical perfection and so on affect both women and men, but I think they affect women more strongly. Women are held to much more rigorous and exacting standards of appearance that affects much more of our bodies. And the problem is when the norms that women are subjected to in terms of physical perfection require them to take risks to harm themselves in order to achieve that perfection. And that's really what we're seeing with some of these forms of surgery.
Claire, thank you very much for your time this morning. Thanks too to Kay and to Susan. Thank you for coming in. Nice to meet you. Now, that's the subject of tomorrow's phone-in with Jenny here on Woman's Hour. Do you feel under pressure to look a certain way, and where does that pressure come from? That's a live phone-in on Woman's Hour tomorrow. You've been listening to the edited highlights of today's Woman's Hour on BBC Radio 4. You can download any item by going to the Woman's Hour website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.